Welcome to the Geographical Podcast, brought to you by Geographical Magazine. I'm Katie Burton, Geographical's editor. This is a special mid-monthly edition of the podcast to coincide with the G7 conference taking place this weekend. Joe Biden and other world leaders are currently in Cornwall with Boris Johnson ahead of the summit, which begins today. In the last issue of the magazine, our geopolitics columnist Tim Marshall wrote a piece all about the G7, and he's going to read that out shortly. Before then, I caught up with Tim to hear more about the G7, what it stands for, and his views on what we can expect to hear from the conference this weekend. So I'm here with Tim Marshall, a geographical contributor and author of several books, including the very popular Prisoners of Geography and then more recently, The Power of Geography. Tim wrote a piece for the June issue of Geographical all about the upcoming G7 conference, and a full read through of that article is coming up. But first of all, we thought we'd catch up with Tim to find out a bit more. So hi, Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invite. It's kind of fun to talk geographical in a podcast.
So the G7 is obviously in the news at the moment due to the conference. But outside of the conference times, it doesn't really feel to me as if it's discussed that much in the media. I mean, on reading your piece, I think I actually came away thinking of it as more significant than maybe I'd given it credit for. How do you think?
Oh dear, I wouldn't want to big it up too much, but yeah, I do make the argument that it does have a role and partially plays it. Well, it's a fairly dry subject, really. I mean, not when you delve into it and you know, people's lives and economies to an extent partially depend on it. But, you know, it is usually six men and one woman all in business suits talking about highfalutin things. But I think the reason it doesn't get that much coverage is that, you know, it happens once a year. We know it happens every year. There are months and months of work in the run-up to it that are done by the Sherpas, as the diplomats call the people that do the heavy lifting all the way up to the mountaintop, so that when these guys are on the mountaintop, they can grip and grin for the cameras and it looks good and make their pronouncements. And, you know, you really don't want to be news media can't be covering the Sherpa work, even though actually the real stories are often in that work, because, you know, one Sherpa will go into Brussels and say, listen, X, Y, and Z, or Paris, or, and then they'll push back and say, well, we can't sign up for that because, and it's all those becauses that are actually where the real action is, the real tensions are within the G7. Because, for example, Biden might well want to push for a really strong statement against China. And when you look at the statement, and if you can find out what's going on behind the scenes, because even the statements, they try to cook them up, you know, well before the final day. And if you can find out that a certain country pushed back, let's say Germany, because of the amount of trade that Germany's doing, and it's a bit frightened of annoying the Chinese, foreign policy is revealed at those moments. So that's what, you know, but you can only really focus on the actual meeting. So the same as the climate change meeting in the autumn in Glasgow. You know, there's bits and bobs floating around, but the media is, you know, we've got Belarus to think about. They have Belarus to think about, and Israel, Gaza, etc.
And in terms of the significance of the G7 now, I mean, you made the point, and we emphasised this on our front cover, actually, that the G7 is a prominent group of democracies. I think you called it a major fixture in the democratic world. I kind of got the impression that you were saying that is one of its most significant features.
Kind of morphed into that. I mean, it was essentially just economic, and then Russia came into it because it, you know, it is a, well, I think its GDP is smaller than Italy's, but, you know, it is a still a power. But then its behavior in Ukraine got it thrown out. And so you're now left with seven properly democratic countries at a time when the leaders of them realize that democracy is under real strains and stresses, and at a time where less democratic and non-democratic nations are beginning to throw their considerable weight around. How do you counter that? Well, there is a military alliance to counter that, and many of the G7 are in it, but there isn't really a coming together of there isn't a forum the democratic nations. So the G7 has sort of partially morphed into that and is the embryo if, and it remains an if there's going to be something more formal like the D10, the 10 democratic countries, or the D20. I mean, there is actually a G20, of course. So, I mean, these are fairly nebulous concepts at the moment, but both Prime Minister Johnson and President Biden are certainly reaching slowly towards this concept that the democratic world needs, at the very least, a forum, if not actually an official structure with which to try to underpin democracy and make sure it doesn't take any more of a battering. Because let's face it, there's been a crisis in confidence about democracy.
It certainly would therefore seem logical that other countries are invited to join or that it expands. Because is there anything that really binds these seven specifically now? Or are they just the leftovers of what it once was?
Well, it is democracy that binds them. You know, China will never be invited into it, or Belarus, you know, many, many other countries. They are the biggest seven economies in the world that are democratic countries. And consequently, they do have it in each other's interest to stick together to try to get their version of what is best for global trade and therefore for their own trade, which of course inevitably brings us to China, because they are concerned about China being so dominant that other economies feel they have to fall into line economically with China to get the best deals around. Because they also know that what would follow from that, because if you're falling into China's economic sphere, you will inevitably fall into China's diplomatic sphere, and people will begin to lean towards Beijing and away from the Western democracies. And so they know they must stick together as a sort of democratic capitalist club to promote their version of trade, which is far more open. I mean, there are anomalies and there are problems with their free trade, and obviously they're all out for themselves. But it's a very different model to the Chinese model, and it does include respecting intellectual property rights and many other aspects of trade. And so I think that's what's underpinning it now. Strengthening democracy, trying to open up global trade, and that includes keeping countries in the periphery, in China's periphery, on side.
And then in terms of what it can actually do and achieve and what comes out of it, is there an area where you think it can have the most impact and that can actually make a difference?
Yes, a number of things. One is economic direction. You know, they can all agree that interest rates need to be X, Y, or Z. I mean, they can't all then go back and tell central banks what to do, but they can have this idea of quantitative easing, of taking your foot off the brake or onto the brake in economic terms, which is very hard to quantify down the line, because you can't always prove 10 months on, well, the decisions made here are why the economies are there. But there is some form of connection, which economists could probably nail down a little better than I could, but even they would struggle to prove it. But there clearly are ramifications of the agreed policies. There are hard and fast things you can measure, such as we pledge X $100 million and each country pledges X amount and it goes into a pot and it is then spent. And there are many, many examples of how it is spent and the good that it has done around the world and the lives it's saved and, you know, the villages that it's changed, whether it's, I don't know, drilling a water well or whatever. Again, that's problematic because many of them pledge, which is easy, and then don't pay. Because, you know, 6 months down the line, the economy is in a bit of trouble and they think, well, you know, I know we said X, but we're going to give Y. So it's not perfect. But the point I'm making is that there are genuine concrete results from the decisions made. And then there's that even more nebulous concept that I came in at the beginning with, which is just sticking together so we don't fall apart.
And then there's also the issue, as you said right at the start, of statement against countries that have done in the eyes of the G7 wrong. And you said, you know, it is easy to be cynical about these things, but it's possibly better than nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to draw attention to that because it's too easy just to say, oh, it's a talking shop. When, yeah, I'll agree with you, it is a talking shop. But that doesn't mean that talking shops don't also have some something going for them and decisions made. Let's say, I mean, we're recording this after, as the Belarus, call it a crisis for want of a better word, has blown up, which, you know, it's a very, very serious issue, this thing about, you know, hijacking an airliner and forcing it to land, a state doing that. Now, by the time we get to Cornwall, it may have blown over from the headlines, but I'm absolutely certain if this had happened during the G7, they would have come up with a hell of a statement condemning it. So far, so much hot air, perhaps, but they would probably also have agreed that they'll go back home and put pressure on their individual airline companies that we're not flying over Belarus anymore. Our aircraft are not going to land in Belarus anymore because that's going to hurt the Belarus economy. So they can actually take concrete action. They tend to only do it if it's something in the news at the time, because, you know, they'd rather not have to get sidetracked onto that. So an example is the G7 after the tsunami, which fractured the Fukushima nuclear power station. They all agreed, and they carried it out, that they would all go home and stress test all the nuclear power stations in all the countries. You could argue they should be doing that anyway, but the point I'm making is that because it's in the headlines and the G7 is meeting, they are under pressure to go and get results and do something.
Well, we will go on and actually hear the article now, and we'll have to wait and see what actually comes out of the conference this year. But thank you for delving into it a bit further with us today.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Talking shop, diplomatic beauty contest, or deep breath, a forum to unite leading democracies to help the world fight and then build back better from coronavirus and create a greener, more prosperous future, as the UK government's G7 website puts it. You can make the case for each definition. You can also argue that the G7 is a combination of all three. Boris Johnson has invited the leaders of Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the USA to tackle the issues mentioned above and more. The Prime Minister says, quote, "As the most prominent grouping of democratic countries, the G7 has long been the catalyst for decisive international action to tackle the greatest challenges we face, from cancelling developing world debt to our universal condemnation of Russia's annexation of Crimea. The world has looked to the G7 to apply our shared values and diplomatic might to create a more open and prosperous planet." Well, some of that's true. Being the most prominent grouping of democratic countries, for example. The rest of it? That requires caveats. Cancelling developing world debt? Well, they keep doing it. 1999, 2005, 2020. The biggest step forward was probably the 2005 agreement, which led to debt cancellation for 36 countries of a combined $130 billion. Now, this initially allowed those countries to reduce their overall debt repayments and plough more money into healthcare and education. However, World Bank data suggests that in the decade following 2005, new lending increased. The Jubilee Debt Campaign calculates that since the 2008 financial crash, 63% of lending to developing countries has been from multilateral institutions, primarily the World Bank and the IMF, and 27% of it has come from governments, including three G7 members, Japan, France, and Germany. Rich nations are also accused of encouraging reckless lending by major private lenders by bailing them out. Now, this doesn't mean the original decisions were wrong, and they have helped to alleviate suffering, but the G7 has certainly not cancelled developing world debt. The condemnation of Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014 won't have kept President Putin awake at night in one of his many palaces, but the economic sanctions that followed may well have curbed his enthusiasm for further overt action. Russia was suspended from what was the G8, and there's no reason to think it'll be readmitted in the foreseeable future. Earlier this year, the G7 committed to continuing sanctions and reaffirmed that the illegal and illegitimate annexation won't be recognised. Another major incursion into Ukraine this year would probably have led to the cancellation of the Nord Stream 2 gas line project, which Moscow needs to boost its ailing economy. As for the world looking to the G7 to apply its shared values, the governments of China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Pakistan, Iran, and a swathe of other countries wouldn't agree, nor would some of their people. However, it's fair to say that many countries do look to the G7 to take action on a range of issues, and that it is a major fixture in the democratic world. The Johnson government knows that democracy is under pressure around the globe amid the rise of authoritarian and populist leaders. The Prime Minister supports the idea of a new grouping of the most democratic and technologically advanced nations standing together on values, science, trade, and even defence. The shorthand for the idea is called the D10. An indication as to who the 10 democracies might be can be found in the invitations to attend this summit as guest countries. They've been sent to the leaders of India, South Korea, and Australia. More than 60% of people living in democracies are in those 10 countries. US President Joe Biden is known to be thinking along similar lines and is expected to outline his thoughts about what he sees as a strategic rivalry between the major democracies and the authoritarian states, particularly China. The Americans will probably push to include a condemnation of Beijing's treatment of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province in the summit's final communique. According to a UN report, at least 1 million Muslim Uyghurs are detained in camps, and activists claim many are subjected to forced labour and even torture. It'll be interesting to see if any countries attempt to water down the communique for fear of economic reprisals. If so, well, that would somewhat undermine claims of shared values. There'll also be discussion about supporting big infrastructure projects in low to middle income countries to try and counter China's Belt and Road strategic policy, which enmeshes countries in its sphere of influence. If it was a normal year, climate change would have led the summit's agenda, but the meeting is dominated by the effect of the COVID-19 crisis on the global economy, and so we're hearing a lot about building back better. As a bloc, well, they can present a united front on supporting the UN efforts to accelerate its global COVAX plan and then back it up with funding. Protesters and activists are being kept a fair distance from Carbis Bay. One of their demands, for leaders to commit to providing vaccines to the developing world, looks as if it's bearing fruit. Up to 1 billion doses are being pledged. Given the levels of debt in the G7 countries, it's worth looking at what is pledged and then looking again in a year's time at what is delivered. Climate change does feature heavily, and there is the expectation of a declaration about net zero emission targets. We'll hear a lot about a push towards techno-green, the idea that new technologies are the key to reducing emissions, and that'll be linked with building back better, or in this case, building back greener. What we'll hear less of is the detail about the costs to consumers of becoming net zero, because the more consumers hear about that, the less they tend to support green measures. Amidst all this, no doubt, attendees such as Canada's Justin Trudeau and France's Emmanuel Macron will be asked why, if they're so concerned about climate change, why have they contributed to carbon emissions by coming along in person? Or, as in Boris Johnson's case, why he actually flew there? The answers will range from security, to we're offsetting by doing X, Y, and Z, to pointing out that the heavy lifting, by what are called Sherpas, was all done by video conference. Diplomacy did indeed go virtual. What they won't say is that it looks great on TV news when you're seen in the company of other powerful people, or that given that this is Biden's first overseas trip as president, you wouldn't want to miss the opportunity to have a word. So Boris Johnson gets his moment in the sun, Cornwall climate allowing. Joe Biden feels the love. Everyone makes heartfelt speeches about rebuilding our world, time running out, and a cleaner, greener future. And then they go home. And then what? Well, some of what they said will happen, will happen. Some of that will make a difference. And then we'll move on to next year's summit, this time in the USA.
That was Tim Marshall reading his piece for the June issue of Geographical. If you like what you heard today, please do subscribe to the podcast. You can keep up to date with future episodes by subscribing to our newsletter. The link's in the bio. Until next time, thank you for listening.